Hi, my name is Mike, and I used to be a banker.
And I'm Gary. I guess I'm sort of still a banker, or at least a private equity investor.
Okay. Perhaps more importantly, you are also, full name Gary Cernowitz, the author of, among other things, The Green and the Black, The Complete Story of the Shale Revolution, The Fight Over Fracking, and the Future of Energy. Thanks for talking.
Thanks for having me.
As you know, I read and really enjoyed your book, and I reviewed it on my site. And I just want to praise you for doing what I think is my favorite thing, which is taking a complex issue upon which nobody agrees and everybody thinks the other side is a complete fucking idiot, and saying, no, we're not all idiots. We could understand each other. So thank you for doing that. That's really great.
Thanks for the praise, and clearly that is not the dominant mode of American discourse, as evidenced by the discussion heading over through November.
Oh, yeah, and it's really difficult to not see the other side as either morons or dupes or evil. And I would say if you just say the word fracking, we've already introduced the idea that the other side is one or all of those things, right? So I appreciate you describing yourself as a New York liberal, and I described you as deep in enemy territory, therefore, for fracking, and yet you have to both answer for your profession, which is to be investors in energy and oil and gas and fracking, but at the same time be a thinking person. So thanks.
Yeah.
It's, oil men, I don't know who's more unattractive, oil men or Wall Street guys, but every once in a while I'll say something mildly positive about a Wall Street guy in some column I write, and inevitably it's like, you're such a jerk talking about the banksters as if they're not all evil. And I'm like, okay, sorry.
I managed to work for a private equity firm that invests in the oil and gas business to be the worst of both worlds, as they like.
So some of the interesting parts about your book are a combination of, I would say, celebrating capitalism, and the ingenuity of the shale revolution and the incremental changes. And then part of that celebrating capitalism is celebrating some of the funny and interesting characters who made good off of the thing. And I'm interested in some of those. Some of them I've heard their names but don't particularly know them, but I understand they're sort of rock stars of your industry. I'd love to just chat about those if you don't mind. Your favorite is seems to be Aubrey McClendon, who I guess died after you'd written the book, because I don't think you reference his death, or maybe you do.
No. He died in what is not terribly clear, but whether it was self-inflicted or not, but drove about 80 miles an hour into a highway overpass the day after being indicted. So obviously a lot of speculation on the timing of that. And
certainly looks suspicious, as a complete outsider.
The conclusions most people have drawn are, I think there's been no official word, from the investigation one way or the other. Not necessarily there needs to be. But, the funny, thing about the book is, there was an alternate book that was just sort of a straight biography of McClendon,
uh-huh.
That kind of was impractical to write, with my job and just sort of with, need to write. He's backed by a firm that, in his later life, he's backed by a firm that, competes against my firm in terms of providing capital to oil men, and so kind of uh-huh. There was that thing. And so I ended up kind of putting that to the side.
But there's a book worth or more of Aubrey McClendon's stories that you would have.
Yeah, then he kind of, every chapter he kind of, he's like Zelig of the book, that he just kind of every chapter he kind of finds his way to, so there is a sort of small Aubrey biography kind of woven through it sort of unwittingly, just because he is one of the more colorful characters. And, he's, kind of partly kind of he harkens back to a different, kind of swashbuckling, kind of capitalism.
Yeah.
Partly, conditions of the oil business of a kind of a wildcatter of, and partly, he did have a very kind of unusual role, just that he, that effectively company he had, Chesapeake, was sort of a thought of as somewhat small, sort of volatile, high risk. Kind of
a wildcatter spirit of a company versus more corporate people.
Yep, and hold on to your seatbelts. When you deal with Aubrey, or and Chesapeake in general, and when the shale revolution started, and it wasn't really him, it was another company, Mitchell Energy, that started it. So when it started, you know, what Aubrey did was really kind of just sort of start this competitive frenzy in successive basins where people would discover, well, maybe we have a shale here in North Louisiana or East Texas or North Dakota on the oil side or Pennsylvania or Ohio. And Aubrey had like just thousands of guys knocking on doors and just an unlimited appetite for capital and complexity and everything. That would just got billions and billions of dollars, and then everyone looked around, and oil companies pursuing a little bit more, you know, kind of normal course ambition, and we're like, well, but Aubrey's going to kind of suck up all the opportunities, and, you know, it's just sort of, so you kind of was the catalyst in these basins for sort of this frenzy, and then ultimately, you know, what happened was one, he kind of didn't fully grasp, and no one did, that how good this was going to be, and so ended up, you know, kind of a lot more gas and a lot more, you know, and crashed the price of gas, you know, because so many basins worked in successively cheaper prices, and then happened similar on the oil side, and then, you know, and then also just any company with too much debt heading into a downturn, you know, kind of, you know, he's always going to be in trouble. So, he kind of got a margin call on his personal account for like $2 billion. Lost.
I should be so lucky someday.
Yeah.
I'll be so upset when I get a $2 billion margin call.
Yeah, and then, or that's how much he was worth at the peak, and I don't know what the margin call was like, a few, but it's like net worth went down by, I think, a couple billion dollars, and then, you know, that was briefly there, and then he kind of got kicked out of Chesapeake because of all sorts of other kind of sort of somewhat old school, you know, CEO perks that that are sort of beyond.
Sort of pledging shares, right, for his own purchases, that kind of thing.
Well, more like basically he had the right to buy interest personally in all the oil wells Chesapeake.
Oh, I see.
Which is kind of a thing that's
conflict of interest in a major scale.
But yeah, just kind of was not done that much anymore, and so he did. Then he got backed by a private equity firm, and they bought $8 billion of properties, oil properties, right before the oil price collapsed. And sort of, you know, the bigger issue facing him was not really this indictment, which is kind of somewhat on a pretty kind of secondary issue, and you know, but really was on sort of financial difficulties and like five or six different companies all bleeding cash and all in big debt problems and just sort of the world coming in, and you know, he owned 20% of the Oklahoma Thunder, and he had pledged that for a loan, and right now I think you have a chance before maybe it was last weekend, for some reason he needed to have the largest collection of Bordeaux in the world, so that's being auctioned off now by his estate. In, you know, bad form and got a lot of bad publicity. He had pledged $20 million to Duke, his alma mater.
Yeah, I read about that. The Duke sort of said, "Oh yeah, where's our 20?" And the heirs didn't find that tasteful, right? So they.
Oh, nor did the Duke alumni, anyone in the Duke community. You know, just say, that's a charitable donation. So I mean, it is unclear what will happen, but it is definitely a sort of a very early 20th century, 19th century sort of Dreiser sort of story of rising and falling and rising and falling. And
Captain of Industry Robert Barron.
Operate outside the kind of realms of normal corporate America or sort of the norms of it. And kind of obviously very entertaining but did have an impact on it. And it was known to be an extremely kind of nice guy, and one thing he was
presumably a gregarious salesman type.
He wasn't cynical, and capital. I mean, his margin call was on buying insatiably stock in his own company, so you know, kind of obviously believed in it.
Yeah.
It was not a dark figure, but you know, kind of an irresponsible figure, and left a lot of, you know, obviously shareholders and partners and everything, you know, with some, you know, holding the bag based on sort of sort of a wild irresponsibility in terms of how he built his business.
What I liked about your, on the one hand, celebration of capitalism and innovation, and in a sense, here's the new, you know, the new shale billionaires, and there's a bunch of, you have a Mount Rushmore of four of them who rose above the others. On the one hand, of course, we have a tradition in the United States of celebrating these people as paragons of capitalism and far-seeing geniuses, of which Arbery is kind of included in that, with Mark Papa from EOG and this guy Harold Hamm, and I guess George Mitchell, one of the originators of the techniques. But then I appreciate that you also say, you know, there's an aspect of the story which is these guys are just sort of dumb luck combined with bizarre personalities that either, you know, like you're describing McClendon with his sort of appetite for risk and appetite for everything. So I appreciate it. And then they kind of trying to figure out, you know, are these guys just beholden to their own personalities and limitations, and that's why they did these odd, risky, crazy things, which turned out to be right place, right time at the right scale, which is obviously huge that they all did it at. There's this awesome passage, which I would also like to read, which is among my favorites of the whole book, which is describing Aubrey. Aubrey feels sometimes like seeing the country's best restaurant critic blissfully eating from a box of day-old donuts. People respect the critic for the sensitivity of his palate, but maybe the man just likes to eat. I really like that one.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. No,
I mean, it is brilliant. It's like it encapsulates like these. We celebrate these capitalists for their amazing talent, and yet I don't know. Maybe the guy's like slightly insane and just has no taste at all. It's just awesome. Of course, I love day-old donuts too, so I can relate.
Yeah, no, it's just. I mean, I think you know, and I think people in the oil business, you know, are very fond of, and probably this is any business, like you know. My successes are because I'm smart. His successes are because he's lucky.
Right, of course, yeah.
So being in a business, one gets, you know, a little bit more color on, you know, on who was lucky, who was smart. You know, most people are some combination thereof. But I think the thing to remember about the entire industry is it was, you know, before the shale revolution, the U.S. onshore, you know, and we had, for instance, a company in Corpus looking in South Texas, you know, was about, like, you know, finding, you know, drilling wells for $400,000 to find $2 million worth of gas. You know, it was really...
It was a little scratchy and peck, kind of little tiny companies.
Yeah, and then it's like, you know, anyone in the oil business like Exxon would just look with contempt, you know, at the U.S. onshore business as just a bunch of losers, right, who couldn't make it in, like, doing, you know, big international stuff in Kazakhstan or offshore, you know, Angola and then all this, or Equatorial Guinea and stuff. And so, you know, there was a certain, you know, very admirable hustle, that kind of never say die that kept, you know, people shouldn't have been drilling before 98 in the U.S. You know, if you think about where were the best reserves of oil and gas, it was just sort of, it was just globally, it was just the infrastructure wasn't there to displace it. And then the shale revolution came and suddenly, you know, it wasn't, the amazing thing wasn't just that actually underneath the stuff that these guys were, you know, scratching and pecking, as you say, were an amazing volume of oil and gas, but actually oil and gas was a lot cheaper to extract than the stuff Exxon was doing. So it's one of these, you know, stories of, you know, the first shall be last shall be first, that, you know, it really came out of nowhere and everyone got caught up in it. And then there's all these micro stories because there's a lot of basins that, you know, have risen. I mean, you know, think about there in the Eagle Ford, which is one closest to you guys.
Yep.
You know, Eagle Ford was, you know, now is, I think, the most shale wells have been drilled in Eagle Ford. It's now kind of a mature basin. And it was really developed by EOG, kind of gets a lot of the credit, Mark Papa, and, you know, kind of was one where it's kind of a stealth play, and then there's just kind of a mad rush for the Eagle Ford. Mm-hmm. Now the Eagle Ford is kind of considered, well, there's, you know, A, it's drilled up a lot, and, you know, some of it's more natural gas, and some of it's more natural gas liquids, and it's not that good. And by the way, if you go to West Texas, the Permian, there's like an Eagle Ford stacked on top of another Eagle Ford, because there's all these, there's thousands of feet of different benches you can drill horizontal wells in. So Eagle Ford is now considered like, okay, a little mature, maybe some opportunities, but you kind of only are interested in kind of moving back there if you can't find anything in the Permian in West Texas and New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So so these rising, and these kind of, there's dozens of different kinds of stories of rises and falls. And the business, not only, it's not, there's not just a lot of, amazing oil men who picked exactly the rise and fall correctly. There were some who were just there in a basin that ended up rising, and there are some mm-hmm. that did guess it correctly. There are some who came in too late and ended up getting, kind of losing a lot of money.
There's a bunch of things I want to follow up on that. One is sort of the Permian, which I don't know much about, but a month ago, the general newspaper readership got a sense that Apache Energy just had a huge find. And the other one, but I want to follow up on sort of the genius capitalists of the thing. There's a local guy who I don't know personally, but was celebrated around the discovery of Eagleford. Suddenly this guy that I hadn't heard of before named Rod Lewis became a known shale revolution gas billionaire. And part of his legend, and I don't think he appears in your book, is as a very blue-collar guy checking old oil wells, and then suddenly, sudden success is always overnight, and it actually took 20 years that we didn't know about.
Yeah.
But you do describe a guy, and I don't know if you have stories about him or his thing, but you do have a guy that sounded very similar to that in your book, Terry Pegula, who sounds similarly this blue-collar guy in the business of helping, plug old oil wells, and then suddenly seems to, out of nowhere, have acquired a massive amounts of leases, which is then first worth $1 billion, then, $3 or $4 billion in a couple years later. Do you know the Rod Lewis story to tell? Local people might be interested. I've only heard basically what I just told you.
I mean, Petro Lewis is a very well-respected company and definitely considered one of the Eagleford's, kind of central private play. I don't know the story, his story particularly, but there was, but the Terry Pegula, who now owns the Bills and the Sabres and, is the savior of Buffalo, was definitely almost like a hoarder of leases.
Clean your stuff out, man. We're going to call the cops on you. He was that guy.
And would take them from other companies with the agreement that I will, plug these wells when, a natural gas well sometimes can, produce for a century maybe,
mm-hmm.
at very low volumes. But the one thing it does is it gives you the right, based on the lease, to actually drill beneath it. So even
mm-hmm.
if you have a well producing $50 a day of stuff, it does give you that optionality for
vertically you can go below that existing
yeah.
small producing well. So that was his
thing. And it really depends on, and he didn't do that on purpose. It just, because, no one thought of, when he was hoarding these leases that there was going to be, Qatar was going to be in Pennsylvania and Eastern Ohio. It was just sort of, he was just doing it because he just liked doing it, So maybe he, and I think also, as a car dealer once said to my wife, his view, and my wife agrees, if it's free, it's for me, And so people would just give it to him, because
yeah.
it took liabilities off their hands. So, I don't know the Petro Lewis story, but, that's one of those kind of amazing stories of sort of the wheels of markets and capitalisms and fortunes and luck. Idiosyncratic, kind of histories
yeah.
that people like to just sort of wrap up sometimes in a more heroic narrative.
Right. Well, we love the narrative of the blue-collar guy making good somehow. I mean, that's a very pleasing capitalist. It's terrible when the rich remain rich. It's great when the poor suddenly get rich.
Yeah, and that's why Harold Hamm, as much as, I was saying, sort of hearing him and getting offended by fracking, he is the single person who has gotten richest individually off the shale revolution.
Okay.
And he had one of 13 kids, in a sharecropper in Oklahoma who,
mm-hmm.
Didn't graduate, barely graduated high school, never went to college, didn't have shoes until he was six, just like an amazing, like a story out of out of a different century.
Yeah.
And now is the 70th richest man in the world. And so that's that story. And a lot of charitable, he signed the giving pledge with Bill Gates and,
yeah. And I think you described him getting into North Dakota because he was one of these losers who had no other chance, kind of.
Exactly. I mean, he's like, I couldn't afford it. And he admits it. He's a kind of a humble guy in some ways. He kind of admits, like, listen, I couldn't afford what we were paying, you know, because basically you're paying option value for leases in North Dakota. Where I heard Harold Hamm speak, and he gave a very long pro-Trump, kind of soliloquy. Okay. Like 45 minutes long with slides and everything, so I guess it was more of a presentation. But we talked about a very obscure argument. I don't even know what happened, but Trump came to Colorado and also said basically the same thing Hillary said, which is community should be allowed to regulate fracking in their backyard.
Right.
And and Ham's like, well, forgive my friend Donald. He didn't know what he was saying. He agrees with me. And even the word fracking, I was hurt. He's one of Donald Trump's chief supporters, and he made it clear that if you use the word fracking around him, the conversation is over because it is an insulting term to describe hydraulic fracturing.
Okay. Words matter, and that's a hurtful word for him.
Yes.
Okay. He sounds a little sensitive, but anyway.
You'd think $70 billion, or 70th richest man in the world and $12 billion should make you less sensitive, but apparently that's not the case.
Okay. You know, words have power, and he's a man who can be hurt by that word. Okay. Interesting. Yes.